Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 1st. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's Triangle Business Journal, first article, top of the fold, German firm picks Raleigh for United States headquarters, by Lauren Onisores. Man and Hummel is making a $15 million bet on North Carolina. Step one was purchasing Fayetteville-based Purolator filters in April. Step two is bringing a 15-employee innovation team to Centennial Campus in Raleigh. And step three, set to be announced November 1st at Centennial Campus, could provide an even bigger economic bounce. The German filtration manufacturer has selected Raleigh for its North American headquarters, specifically to house its automotive aftermarket and industrial filtration divisions. Mann and Hummel plans to invest more than $15 million in its Fayetteville and Raleigh sites over the next 2 years. For newly minted Triangle resident Charles Valiant, the news is a personal victory. It was Valiant, Vice President of Innovations and Corporate Strategy at Mann and Hummel, who pushed his bosses in Stuttgart to focus on the Triangle, and he was thinking about Raleigh well before the Fayetteville acquisition. I truly believe that the level of creativity and innovation that you find in the United States is tremendous and want to explore this, he says, adding that he jumped in personally, moving his family to the Triangle this past July. This is very important to me, and I am very convinced this is the right direction. But it's not Mann and Hummel's first foray into the United States. The company established an outlet in Glenview, Illinois in 1994, and has since concentrated a lot of its automotive work in Michigan. Mann and Hummel, founded in 1941 as an automotive components supplier, employs 14,575 people at more than 50 locations worldwide. Currently, its research headcount is about 1,000. The company reported sales of $3.6 billion in 2012. The Nonwovens Institute at North Carolina State University was what attracted his attention in the first place, Valiant says. The company already has started to move into two spaces, an 8,000-square-foot facility on Corporate Center Drive and a 3,000-square-foot Centennial Campus Lab in the Partners One building. The sales and marketing team for its Purolator division is at Corporate Center Drive, and executives are in the process of transitioning to the site. This is a big step forward because it's the first time in the history of the company that we're establishing a research center outside of company walls, he says, adding that he looked at research institutions across the globe before deciding on NCSU. We're looking over the last year. We really have been speeding up our path to innovation, and to do this we need to get out of only doing it in Europe. We want to do this on a global basis. By providing an office across the hall from the machinery and lab researchers that use them at NCSU, the Centennial Campus made the best case. The proximity is a huge benefit, he says. We've been working with the Institute for a couple of years from Europe, but as you can imagine, working so many miles away, it's not easy. That is no longer. Valiant hopes to look across the hall for recruitment and is already starting. The first PhD has been hired from North Carolina State University. He expects to see more than 60 employees between the two Raleigh facilities in the next 2 years, and is already looking for engineers. Most of these are new hires, he said, adding that the current Raleigh headcount stands at about 25. The Fayetteville facility employs 1,000 people currently. Manfred Wolf, president and general manager of the automotive and industrial business, says the collaborative research helps Mann and Hummel pivot towards innovation and new technology. Innovation is who we are, he says in a statement. Innovation is what our customers expect, and we are happy to help them solve their challenges today and in the future. And North Carolina State University is only too happy to oblige. Jean Pinder of the Centennial Campus says researchers have already started working with the Nonwovens Institute on new filtration technology. Besides being another good example of the corporate academic partnership that are being developed in Centennial with respect to research and development, this is also a good one because of the Fayetteville connection and the fact that this is a manufacturing concern which all of the politicians are anxious to grow, he says. It's also a good story because of the role the Nonwoven Institute plays, which is the largest of its kind in North America. Next up, money on the move, how wealth migrates. Multiple factors contribute to gain and loss of wealth in the Triangle. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. There are lots of reasons people move to North Carolina and to the Triangle every year. Usually it's related to a job transfer or to be closer to family in the region. For Greg and Jocelyn Stoke, who relocated to Raleigh from Las Vegas in May, it was neither of those reasons. They have no family in the Triangle, and both are still searching for new jobs. They say their decisions to move was more about being in a place that was fun and where they felt welcome. I can't tell you how many people have said to us, how can I help you, and welcome to North Carolina. It's really nice, she says. The Stokes also brought with them from Las Vegas and Phoenix before that all of their personal income and wealth that is now being reinvested in the Triangle community through their ticket purchases to North Carolina Symphony shows, dinners at local restaurants, and rent for the apartment where they live until they find a more permanent home. North Carolina ranks behind only Florida and Arizona in the top category for net wealth gained between 1992 and 2010, according to a study of IRS tax data released earlier this year. The Tar Heel State gained an additional $25 billion in adjusted gross income from new people moving in during that time period. About 29% of that additional income came from people coming in from New York and New Jersey. On a local level, Wake County, Chatham County, Johnston County, and Franklin County have benefited the most from the new wealth moving around and into the state with a combined $7.1 billion gained in adjusted gross income. Durham County and Orange County lost $358 million and $50 million, respectively, in adjusted gross income, but almost all of that loss was to its neighboring counties in the Triangle. The biggest swing was $405 million in personal income moved from Durham County to Wake County, according to the same data. Most of those people are looking around at different housing or different schools, but they are not typically leaving North Carolina, which is good, says Travis Brown, author of the book How Money Walks, which looks at migration patterns of wealth across the United States over the last two decades. Many residents and real estate experts say the recent issues surrounding school assignment changes at Wake County Public School System has caused confusion among people moving to the region, and many families have opted to avoid the process altogether by buying a home in another area. Matt White, for example, is an Air Force veteran who used to move around every two or three years. After he finished graduate school at UNC Chapel Hill in 2009, he and his wife decided to settle down in the Triangle. We like the area, he says. They bought a home in Durham because it was affordable and centrally located. But as their older daughter was getting ready to enter kindergarten, White says they started looking around again at other housing options. Wake County was never a serious option, he says, because they were turned off by the turmoil at the Wake County schools. Briar Chapel and Chatham County had the best set of incentives, he said. It's not any secret they have lower taxes and good schools. And while the prices aren't cheap here, they're not off the chart either. White says they still own and are still renting their house in Durham, and while their tax bill and sewer utilities for their home in Chatham County is roughly the same as their home in Durham County, the house in Chatham County has an assessed value of about $50,000 more, he says. Now, this place is more rural, and we're 2 to 3 miles to anything, so it's not apples to apples, but you get the picture, he says. The real reasons people move from one region to another are usually less tangible, says Jeremy Holden, a marketing and brand specialist who has worked with clients at McKinney in Durham and with publicists in New York, until recently starting his own company, Clean Strategy Group, in Raleigh. Holden himself, a transplant to the Triangle 20 years ago from the UK, says the people he's met from Boston, New York, or other big metropolitan cities who have moved to the Triangle usually fall into brackets. They either embrace the area for its climate, its housing options, its proximity to the mountains and the beach, or they are people in that classic two-year cycle, he says. Something is inherently missing for them. They want to be able to eat anytime, anywhere, have a variety of shows and entertainment. They need that buzz of the city, and even though Raleigh has progressed over the last few years, they may still need more, and that's fine. Holden still notes, however, that the Triangle still lacks a large number of corporate headquarters that would attract C-level executives who would relocate here to make more money, as well as C-level executives already here who might pursue opportunities to move around to other companies in the region. When you make a migration yourself, you take on a dramatic change and a dramatic risk, Holden says. Job opportunities for C-level executives are extremely limited here. And what if it doesn't work out? In Manhattan, there are a million other companies you can go to work for, but if you move to this area and want to work in advertising, for example, you have limited options. If the Triangle had more headquarters and more people understanding the progress this market has made, then the secret will really be out. A side column to this article about how wealth migrates: the wealth drain. More than $1 billion in personal income has moved to Johnston County in the last 20 years, with more than half coming from Wake County. Chris Johnson, Economic Development Director for Johnston County, says that improvements to the highways and road systems connecting Raleigh to Clayton have opened up rural farmland to new residential development. New home inventory, particularly in the western half of the country, has enticed potential buyers in the large communities like Flowers Plantation and Riverwood. We've now got things that are comparable to what people are accustomed to in Wake County, like upscale grocery stores and dining, Johnston says. We're not at the end of the world out here. We do have all our teeth. Statewide, North Carolina has attracted most of its new wealth from New York, New Jersey, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Colorado, according to the database of migration statistics from the Internal Revenue Service compiled by Travis Brown for How Money Walks and the accompanying smartphone app. When people have left North Carolina, they relocated primarily to South Carolina, Tennessee, Colorado, Wyoming, and Oregon. North Carolina has been the beneficiary of higher tax regions in the North and from everybody going back and forth to Florida, which has no state income tax. We know that voters prefer to go where their income is most protected and most welcome. Next up, regulators approve Duke's energy saving payout plan. By John Downey, from Charlotte. North Carolina regulators have approved a new process for compensating Duke Energy Carolinas for its energy efficiency and demand-side management programs, replacing the highly successful but complicated Save-A-Watt system. The new compensation process involves a shared savings model. Under the plan, customers would get 88.5% of the savings realized from efficiency and conservation. Duke would make an 11.5% return on the savings. Duke worked out the proposal and a settlement with environmental groups, which welcomed the new compensation methods approval Monday by the North Carolina Utilities Commission. The environmental groups say the new approach allows Duke to profit from efficiency and conservation programs, but only if customers save money. The plan aligns the utility's return on energy efficiency investments with program performance and customer savings, says Greg Andak of the Environmental Defense Fund. The company will be motivated to invest in cost-effective programs to increase energy efficiency. The new process is similar to the one used by Duke Energy Progress, which that utility adopted before Duke Energy Corp. bought its parent, Progress Energy Incorporation, last year. But the change eliminates a feature that attracted national attention when Save-A-Watt was proposed in 2007. The Save-A-Watt process sought to allow Duke to profit on its investments in energy savings, essentially the same way it profited on building power plants. Environmental and consumer groups were suspicious of that plan from the start, fearing it would allow Duke to make unreasonably high profits from modest energy savings. Duke eventually found the compensation process cumbersome and difficult to navigate, leading to annual disputes over how the company calculated what customers should pay. But Save-A-Watt allowed Duke to introduce highly successful efficiency and conservation programs. A study last year by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, which opposed the original Save-A-Watt proposal, showed that Duke provided more energy savings at a lower cost than any other utility in the Southeast. Most of the programs will stay the same or be expanded by Duke Carolinas. What will change is how Duke is compensated. Duke Energy's support for the new and improved plan not only signals the company's long-term commitment to energy efficiency in North Carolina moving forward, it also provides increased certainty to clean energy businesses as they plan whether and where to create new manufacturing, sales, and installations in the South and in the state, says Lowell Sachs of the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association. Duke also qualifies for a $400,000 bonus for each program that improves the energy savings provided to customers by 1 percentage point. Andex says that will help Duke achieve the goal it set in its merger with Progress Energy to get energy savings up to 7% of customer demand by 2018. The Commission's decision also codifies concessions that environmental groups won from Duke in negotiations. Duke is to meet with the watchdog group NC Warn within 90 days to discuss efficiency programs for low-income customers. Local news. Joseph DeSimone to step down from Keenan Post. By Don Curry from Chapel Hill. Prominent Triangle scientist Joseph DeSimone, director of the Keenan Institute of Private Enterprise, is stepping down from his position at the end of the year. DeSimone was named director last year when he replaced John Carsata. DeSimone serves on the Research Triangle Foundation Board and is the co-founder of Liquida Technologies. The Keenan Institute pursues research, educational programs, and public policy initiatives in the area of entrepreneurship, economic development, and global competitiveness. An interim director will be named shortly, said DeSimone in an emailed statement. We just completed a great strategic planning process to reposition the KI to be a partner for innovative entrepreneurship. That mission will continue and is greatly aligned with a similar focus at UNC Chapel Hill and for the region. DeSimone also serves as a UNC Chapel Hill professor of chemistry and is a professor of chemical engineering at NC State University. I plan to resume my full activities in chemistry and chemical engineering at UNC Chapel Hill and NCSU, says DeSimone. I just landed an almost $5 million grant from the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, DTRA, using microneedles in chembio defense, and I'm assisting with the launching of a new company in 3D additive manufacturing that is in the early stages of information. This week's column from Amanda Hoyle covers commercial and real estate, residential real estate. University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill construction is at record lows. The construction activity around the campus of the University of North Carolina is at its lowest level in nearly two decades. The campus currently has 10 projects under construction valued at a total of $311.6 million and another 35 construction or renovation projects that are in the design phase or not yet funded. The last time that UNC Chapel Hill had fewer than 10 major construction projects underway at the time was in early 1994. And it's been since early 2004 that the dollar value of campus construction projects dropped below $400 million. Those numbers don't count the nearly $395 million in building projects that have been completed on campus since late 2012, including the $239.5 million Bell Tower development project and the $104 million new dental sciences building. Many of the projects completed on campus in the last decade were funded as part of the $3.1 billion bond referendum approved in 2000. But the more recent projects have been funded through state appropriations from the General Assembly, private gifts, or other sources. Continuing on in Ms. Hoyle's column, there's a retirement resort on tap for North Raleigh. Nebraska senior housing developer Resort Lifestyle Communities will start moving dirt next week on construction of $27.8 million apartment community for seniors on Ray Road in North Raleigh. The Capital Oaks Retirement Resort will function like a traditional apartment community with month-to-month rent for 1, 2, or 3-bedroom units, but with no additional buy-in or substantial deposit that is sometimes required for independent living communities. But rents for its 130 apartment units will not be cheap. Monthly rental rates are expected to start around $2,500, which includes most utilities, 3 daily meals, weekly housekeeping, social activities, and transportation services. RLC also has financing options available. The Raleigh property, located near the intersection of Ray Road and Leesville Road, next to Calvary Presbyterian Church, will be the 10th senior adult community built by Resort Lifestyle Communities and its first in North Carolina. Other real estate happenings in Raleigh? A 23-story tower is slated for downtown Raleigh. Construction is slated to start within the next few days on the $60 million Sky House apartment building in downtown Raleigh. At 23 stories tall, it will be the tallest residential rental property in the Triangle, with 320 apartment residences and 5,400 square feet of retail space. The project is a joint venture between Atlanta-based Novara Group and Batson Cook Development Company, as well as Greg Sondre's Edison Land LLC, that will still own the land and serve as local development partner. The luxury high-rise building is slated to open to tenants in the fourth quarter of 2014. Sky House Raleigh will be modeled after the group's Sky House Midtown property in Atlanta that opened in December. Rental rates at Sky House Midtown start at $1,142 a month for a studio unit and start at $2,677 for a 3-bedroom unit. Amenities will include floor-to-ceiling glass, a club room, fitness area, and an outdoor plaza on the 23rd floor that will also have a swimming pool, fireplaces, and a 360-degree view of the Raleigh skyline. This week's column on technology and entrepreneurism is by Lauren Onisorge. Her article is on vaulting from engineer to founder. Mint.com founding engineer Purnima Vijay Ashankar didn't set out to start a profitable technology company, but that's what she did. Now she has some advice for tech-driven entrepreneurs looking to shift from founding engineer to founder. It's a bigger gap, she says, than she initially realized. Vijay Ashankar, who just returned to teach at her alma mater, Duke University, saw herself as a writer with an inner creativity that was too big for the white-walled cubicles her father, an engineer, had settled into. She recalls a first visit to his laboratory at Texas Instruments, how she looked forward to tasting those wafers and chips her father was always talking about. Instead of the potato chips she expected, she saw silicon and people in spacesuits. 10-year-old Vijay Ashankar was drawn to a glass box in the middle of the room with a single robotic arm. I immediately got fascinated and forgot I was there to try the chips and wafers, she says. That immediately sparked her interest in technology, but it wasn't until then the economics major took a computer science course that Vijay Ashankar saw engineering in her future. She left the Triangle to go where other engineers were congregating, Silicon Valley. There she helped her co-founder come up with the name Mint.com, becoming the founding engineer of the company that was later sold to Intuit for $170 million. The sale meant a crossroads. Should she stay on at Intuit or take the next step from founding engineer to founder? She took the latter choice, turning a love of yoga into a business with membership management software firm BusyBee. But she soon discovered that founding your own company alone is a bigger challenge than just creating the technology. It's not just about the management skills needed to formulate a team, it's also the vision. And you can't fake vision, she says. This is not something a lot of first-time entrepreneurs are aware of, and it hits you in the face, she says. You have to be enthusiastic about your business, and a lot of that stems from what the business is. Vijay Ashankar says you can't just have a neat technology. You need to have a technology that solves a problem you are passionate about. The best example she can muster is her current project, Femgeneer, an educational website that stemmed from a blog she was writing. She didn't go about trying to create a company. The company found her. And for the time-sensitive entrepreneur, she says, work on your own project incrementally. No one is going to take your idea, she says. Jason DeBrune has a column that covers healthcare and nonprofits, and his article is entitled, Duke Endowment Inching Towards Pre-2008 Level. The Duke University Endowment has nearly regained all of the losses incurred during the economic crisis, sitting at $6 billion after the 2012-13 school year. That's only $100 million below the high mark set after the 2007-08 year and well above the $4.4 billion it fell to after the 2008-09 year when the market crashed. About one-fifth of the endowment provides scholarships to students who are accepted to Duke but cannot afford the tuition. University officials pride themselves on the fact that Duke finds a way to offer scholarships to students who are accepted to the university but cannot pay the tuition. In the 2012-13 school year, for example, Duke charged $642 million in total tuition, but awarded $250 million in student aid. In looking at the performance over the longer period, the Duke endowment, as with all endowments, is climbing out of the hole created by the economic crisis. Many endowments track performance on 3-, 5-, and 10-year rolling averages. Performance for the 3-year averages ticked up last year as the bad years from the economic crises rolled off the years counted towards the average. Conversely, the 5-year averages still look different because the counted years no longer include the strong gains from before the crash. The past 3 years have been largely strong on Wall Street, meaning those 5-year averages will creep up again as time goes forward. The university endowment is separate from the Duke endowment, which makes and is headquartered in Charlotte and makes grants to various charitable organizations. Next up, medical school enrollment reaching record high. Medical schools nationwide set a record in first-time applications, total applications, and first-time enrollment in 2013. Total first-time medical school enrollment reached 20,055 for the 2013-14 school year. First time this nation broke the 20,000 barrier, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. The figure is 2.8% higher than last year and 21.6% higher than 2002. First-time applicants, seen as an important barometer, increased by 5.8% to 35,727. That's the highest year-over-year increase since 2007 and the second highest in the past decade. At a time when the nation faces a shortage of more than 90,000 doctors by the end of the decade and millions are gaining access to health insurance, we are very glad that more students than ever want to become physicians, said AAMC President and CEO Dr. Daryl G. Kirsch. Duke, however, saw applications drop in both 2009-10 and 2010-11 school years, and application numbers have only reached the 2009 levels this year. Campbell University admitted its first class of medical students this year, but these students are not counted by the AAMC. Campbell's is a school of osteopathic medicine, which is different from the medical schools at Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill. Graduates have all the same rights and privileges, but fall under different associations. First-time enrollment in these kinds of schools reached 6,641 this year, an 11% increase over last year. This week's column from Dawn Curry. Dawn covers money and small business, and her first article is entitled, New Cary Brewery to Feature English Ales. Fort Knight Brewery will open in Cary in the next 2 months, brewing and serving English ales. Stuart Arnold, Mo Mercado, David Garner, David Wilkinson, Will Gretchen, and former Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina CEO and current interim president and CEO of LipoScience, Bob Gretchen, have purchased a large building in 1006 Southwest Maynard Road and are upfitting it for beer brewing, tasting, storing, and selling homebrew supplies. With breweries popping up all over the triangle, Arnold says his company will stay ahead of the curve through its originality and location. Also, the Research Triangle Cleantech Cluster snags its first member. The Research Triangle Cleantech Cluster, RTCC, has announced its first industry member. OSI Soft, based in San Francisco, California, which has an office in Wilmington. The company provides software packages for smart grid infrastructure and assists cities moving towards smart grids. OSI Soft offers deep industry knowledge and experience collaborating with innovators in every aspect of smart grid, smart water, and smart transportation, including many of our cluster companies. RTCC Managing Director Leanne Nance said in a recent release. The company is also a leader in smart city visioning and development, which should benefit our Chatham Park technology partnership. Though the partnership, RTCC members will play a lead role in developing a model sustainable smart city on 7,000 acres in Chatham County. RTCC industry members need not live in the area, says Nance. They simply must be interested in networking with other clean tech companies located in the area and pay a $15,000 annual fee. 11 board members pay $25,000 annually. Currently, there are 200-plus number of Triangle-based clean tech companies that the RTCC Fund helps with company branding, studies, and programming, according to Manager Director Leanne Nance. Also, Clean Design spins off a strategy division. Raleigh-based Clean Design, owned by Natalie Perkins, has led to the creation of partner agency Clean Strategy, owned by Perkins' husband, Jeremy Holden. Given the increased transparency of today's marketplace, branding must be authentic, compelling, and insightful, Perkins says. This is what we've always done. Now we're doing it in a bigger way. Clean Design is the marketing agency behind John Deere, Red Hat, and Lenovo. Clean Strategy will examine companies and work to help them internally align with their external marketing campaign. Clean Design and Clean Strategy work out of the same offices in West Raleigh. And now it's time for A Better World. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Benevolence Farm will offer post-prison jobs and housing to women. This article is by Todd Cohen. In 2012, 2,647 women were released from North Carolina prisons. And with roughly 60% of the women who were released from U.S. prisons rearrested and nearly a third of them returned to prison within 3 years, women who get out of prison can use help to succeed on the outside. Typically, they have very low skills, a very poor employment history, a lack of education, and minimal social support, says Tanya Gisa, a social worker who lives in Carrboro. Gisa is creating Benevolence Farm, a working farm in Alamance County that will house and employ 12 women for up to 2 years after release from any of the state's 6 prisons for women. With 11 acres donated by an Alabama businessman who received the land in a court settlement, Gisa is trying to raise $450,000 in contributions to help secure a $600,000 no-interest loan from the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency to build a residence and farm building totaling 6,000 square feet. She has already raised nearly $200,000, including $60,000 needed to help secure the loan, and hopes to open the farm in 2015. Thanks to Jen Snyder and her partner, Aaron Kimry, who live in Hillsboro, the Arizona-based Snyder Family Charitable Fund has provided $20,000 in seed money, another $120,000 to fund Jesus' position and develop a strategic plan, and another $50,000 this year, half of it in the form of a matching grant designed to generate other contributions. Consultant Ruth Peebles of the INS Group in Raleigh helped develop the strategic plan. Benevolence Farm also raised $10,500 in October at an event at the Hall River Ballroom at Saxapa Hall. The nonprofit will work with reentry officials, chaplains, and social workers at the State Department of Public Safety to identify potential candidates, then meet with them and give them the opportunity to visit the farm and apply for admissions. The organization is targeting women with sentences of 5 years or more, typically for felonies, who have the most difficulties finding success after prison, Jesus says. Those are the women we want to reach out and help. Benevolence Farm will pay the women a wage for working on the farm, which mainly will grow vegetables, and charge them for room and board and for programs that will focus on teaching financial literacy, job readiness, family reunification, marketing, and entrepreneurship. The farm will also set aside some of the wages to create savings accounts for the residents. In addition to GISA, a farm manager and possibly a case manager and house manager, the farm expects to work with student interns from Central Carolina Community College in Pittsburgh, A&T University in Greensboro, Elon University in Elon, and UNC Chapel Hill. And it will partner with nonprofits and other agencies that can provide social and legal services as well as educational classes. Women leaving prison typically have what state officials characterize as a questionable home plan, GISA says. We aim to offer them stable housing and gainful employment. Also in the nonprofit world, Wake County Smart Start received a three-year grant of $295,496 from the John Rex Endowment to create a coordinated system to ensure that home visiting services are more easily accessible to the community. The new program is called Wake Connections, Partnerships to Support Young Children at Home. Funding will be used to coordinate home visiting programs in the county that serve children from birth to 5 years. Additionally, the initiative will provide support for parents and other agencies wishing to make referrals or seeking guidance. A goal of the program is to simplify access to services for families of young children in Wake County. Also, Lenovo recently kicked off its annual employee giving campaign. Lenovo matches 50% of eligible employee donations to local organizations and also subsidizes all administrative fees. So 100% of employee donations go directly to their chosen charities. In addition, the company is giving employees 8 hours of paid time off annually so they can devote the time to community service projects. Next up, Washington Watch by Kent Hoover. Mr. Hoover is the chief of the Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau. First up, Small Business Association backs $29 billion in loans to small businesses in fiscal 2013. Thanks partly to a surge in lending before the government shutdown, the Small Business Administration supported more than $29 billion in loans in fiscal 2013, its third biggest year ever. This total includes lending through SBA's two main loan programs, its flagship 7A program and 504 loans, which primarily are used for real estate. Nearly $18 billion in 7A loans were approved for its fiscal 2013, which ended September 30th. Lending through this program was well above 2012 levels, but 504 lending declined because of the end of a temporary program that allowed small businesses to use the 504 program to refinance commercial real estate mortgages. SBA's weekly lending report, meanwhile, shows that 7A lending is picking up steam after being halted by the government shutdown, which lasted from October 1st through October 16th. As of October 25th, nearly $603 million in 7A loans to 1,927 small businesses had been approved since lending resumed. In fiscal 2013, the SBA backed more than 54,000 loans through the 7A and 504 programs. That's far short of the 61,689 loans it guaranteed in fiscal 2011, when SBA lending boomed thanks to temporary breaks such as reduced fees and higher government guarantees that Congress enacted in order to boost lending following the crisis. Last year's lending levels remained strong, however, particularly for the 7A program. Acting SBA Administrator Jean Hewlett said this demonstrates the strength and resiliency of America's 28 million small businesses as they continue to recover from the Great Recession and drive our economy forward. Next, the Senate to vote on a bill extending workplace protection to gays. The Senate will vote on legislation to ban workplace discrimination against gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender Americans. State Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, a Democrat of Nevada, announced he would bring the Employment Non-Discrimination Act to the Senate floor for a vote sometime before Thanksgiving. "We haven't taken this up for a number of years," Reid said. The House passed an earlier version of the ENDA in 2007 when Democrats controlled that chamber, but transgender Americans weren't included in that bill's protections. The legislation would prohibit employers from firing or refusing to hire people based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, extending workplace protections that already apply to race, religion, gender, national origin, age, and disability. Many states bar discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, but it's legal in 28 states. Advocates of gay and transgender rights think they've got a good chance of getting ENDA passed in the Senate. A Senate committee approved the bill on a 15-7 vote in July, with three Republicans joining Democrats in the support of the measure. It's not clear, however, if supporters will get the 60 votes they need to clear procedural hurdles in the Senate. The bill would then face an uphill battle in the House. Many large corporations support the legislation, but business groups have remained mostly silent on this issue. The legislation exempts religious organizations and businesses with fewer than 15 employees from its non-discrimination requirements. This week's opinion and editorial page has two articles on it. The first is by Sugata Mukherjee, who is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. His column is entitled, Apple's Quarter Offers, Critical Lesson. It's not that I like to be on the Apple bandwagon, scarfing up every bit of news that comes out of the iPhone maker. But Apple's fourth quarter earnings release gave me pause. The company sold about 33 million iPhones, 14 million iPads, and 4.6 million Macs in the past quarter. Yes, you read that right. That's sales in 3 months, and yet the stock dropped about 3% following the earnings release that beat top-line and bottom-line estimates. So what exactly is Wall Street asking for from Apple? Is it saying that selling 34 million iPhones is not good enough? The answer to that is yes. Thanks to our technology reporter, I got hold of the hot-off-the-press International Data Corp's smartphone market report to get an understanding of the mobile market. Folks, it looks crazy. IDC estimates the smartphone market grew almost 39% in the past quarter when compared to the same time last year. More than 237 million new smartphones were shipped during the quarter. Is there any doubt that mobile phones are killing every form of computer equipment? Not that people will stop buying desktops and laptops, just that the growth in the foreseeable future is in the smartphones and tablets. Apple had a 13% smartphone worldwide market share as of October, and even after selling 33 million phones during the quarter, its market share went down. That's because Samsung sold 81 million smartphones during the same quarter. With many thanks to Asia, Samsung's worldwide smartphone market share is 31.4%. And other than Morrisville's Lenovo, it is the only smartphone maker that managed to increase market share during the quarter. For comparison, Lenovo is a small-time player in this field with a 4.7% slice of the growing pie. Why do all of these boring statistics matter to you ask? Well, because so much of your firm's success depends on the market you are serving. If you are gaining market share in a market that is not growing, chances are you will need to reinvent your company. If you are gaining market share in a market that is growing faster, your competitors are doing a better job in marketing and selling their product. And if you are losing market share in a market that is growing rapidly, you are falling behind in the race, something that is happening to Apple. But still, it's hard to fathom that after selling 33 million units in one quarter, people think that was not enough. Just think of the pressure Apple CEO Tim Cook and his management face every day, and you should be happy with the job you have. This week's guest opinion column is by Mr. Jim Simpson. Mr. Simpson is the president of the North Carolina Chamber Services in Raleigh. His column is entitled, Defined Contribution Health Plans Help Remove Budget Uncertainties. Health insurance premiums have risen more than 130% during the last decade, more quickly than inflation and wages, and this pace is simply not sustainable. The North Carolina Chamber frequently polls its membership, and we have consistently found that health care is a top-of-mind business for North Carolina businesses. Currently, there is a great amount of uncertainty about how the Affordable Care Act will impact companies and their long-term health care costs. As the ACA is coming to bear, many businesses are beginning to incur greater costs, and it may get to the point where employers are asking themselves, do I offer this benefit, health insurance, or do I create a job? Because health benefits are important to a company's ability to attract top-tier talent, most employers do not want to simply drop coverage. It is possible, though, that they will move away from traditional defined benefit plans. Most small to medium-sized employers today pick one health insurance carrier and bundle that coverage with dental, vision, etc., and each of their employees is provided that same plan, a defined benefit. We believe that approach will shift to what is called a defined contribution model, where the employer will contribute a set amount to a tax-advantaged vehicle, like an HRA or an HSA, negotiate specific major medical options, and let the employees decide how to spend the balance on other benefits such as dental, vision, or covering their out-of-pocket deductible. This approach allows employers to budget for the defined contribution and set a percentage increase each year, which brings an enormous amount of certainty to what has been historically a very unpredictable cost. With that in mind, North Carolina Chamber Services, Incorporated, an affiliate of North Carolina Chamber, will offer a private health insurance and benefits marketplace, also known as an exchange, through CeloStar, a nationwide health care payment and benefit technology firm. North Carolina companies will be able to offer their employees to a one-stop online marketplace to shop for health insurance and other voluntary benefits. For any private exchange to work, there must be choices. The North Carolina Chamber and CeloStar are in discussions with a number of carriers to bring the best choices available in one marketplace. Similar to travel websites that allow consumers to shop for airfare, hotels, and rental cars in one place, the North Carolina Chamber Marketplace will offer a variety of insurance plans for the North Carolina consumers to choose from, including health, dental, vision, life, disability, and more. Coupled with competitive price comparisons, employees can create a plan based on their specific needs and budget. The North Carolina Chamber Marketplace is different than healthcare.gov. The federal exchange is primarily focused on individuals who are not insured, as well as small businesses that do not currently offer health insurance. The North Carolina Chamber Marketplace is designed for employers, most of which currently have a health insurance plan but simply cannot sustain the increasing cost. This provides them with an alternative to dropping coverage altogether. Many businesses can move forward this defined contribution model and maintain coverage for their employees. Another difference is that the North Carolina Chamber Marketplace offers more than just major medical coverage. Employers that enroll on our private exchange will negotiate a health care plan for their employees, then provide their employees with an online shopping experience for other voluntary and ancillary benefits. This allows employees to purchase the benefits most suitable to their unique situation. Providing flexibility and options for both employers and employees was a key reason for the North Carolina Chamber Marketplace was launched. As businesses plan for future growth, the unpredictability of burgeoning health care costs is a large factor hindering job growth. Companies that choose private exchanges to offer a defined contribution can expect greater certainty in their costs while continuing to provide a valuable benefit to their employees. In short, it's a win-win that will hopefully allow all companies and their employees to continue to prosper and grow. Next up are a few articles from the Triangle Biz column. It's a column collected of small articles and little bits of information that always float about the business community here in the Research Triangle Park. The first tidbit is called Leadership Expert Launches a New Book. It was a packed house on October 29th for the launch of Grinnell Leadership founder John Grinnell's first book, Beyond Belief, Awaken Potential, Focus Leadership. Hosted by Raleigh lawyer and Duke Law professor Marilyn Forbes at her home near downtown Raleigh, Grinnell invited some of his clients and closest friends to talk briefly about the book that centers on leadership and how to break down communication barriers in the workplace. While there, Triangle Business Journal had a chance to chat with First Citizens Bank Vice President Hope Connell, Duke University Hospital President Kevin Sowers, Trademark Properties, Billy Redmond, and former Campbell University Law School Dean Melissa Essery. Scoping the room, Triangle Business also noticed McDonnell York Building Company's Heather Denny, Pepsi Bottling Ventures' Randy Kirk, and Balfour Beatty's Johnny Rankin mingling and offering their goodwill to Mr. Grinnell. KidGrid exhibit powers up in downtown Raleigh. Sally Edwards, president of Marbles Kids Museum, says that coming November you'll see changes happening in downtown Raleigh. Specifically, construction on a new KidGrid exhibit starts and it will change the exterior of the kids' museums, she told the crowd at a recent Marbles Big Idea Forum. Marbles is partnering with ABB, which has its North American headquarters in Cary, to develop the new interactive exhibit. Organizers say KidGrid will feature playful activities in a pretend power grid and is on track to open by next summer. Also, accountants rally for the First Tee program. Be careful if challenging Leonard Austin of PricewaterhouseCoopers Raleigh office. The PricewaterhouseCoopers Foundation recently supported four regional First Tee chapters, Triangle, Triad, Charlotte, and Spartanburg, South Carolina, with a donation of about $17,500 each. But there was an additional chance to raise that donation level. The challenge was to see which PWC offices would volunteer the most time to their local First Tee chapters during August and September. Austin accepted that challenge, and according to the folks at the Triangle First Tee, PWC's local employees donated 234 hours during those 2 months, with 71% of the employees participating in the program. Promptly, the PWC Foundation donated an additional $12,500 to the local chapter's cause. So, if your taxes are late, now you know why. Kudos to Austin and his Raleigh team. The nonprofit First Tee helps young people by reinforcing values such as integrity, respect, and perseverance through the game of golf. Next up, new ABB chief, glad to be back in Cary. Greg Hsu, the new North American head for ABB, is glad to be back in Cary. Hsu, who was just appointed to the position, had previously served ABB in Switzerland. Prior to that, he had been in Cary for more than a decade. So Biz had to ask, now that he's back, what did he miss about the Triangle? Barbecue, he says, and ACC sports. It was really tough to get any coverage on local sports in Switzerland, he says. And for the record, he's a State fan. Also, Red Hat celebrates a collaborative culture. To culminate We Are Red Hat Week, many of Red Hat's 900 Raleigh workers took to the streets last Friday for a fun run to highlight employee culture. Hundreds of signature red fedoras could be seen pouring out of Red Hat Tower on Wilmington Street. The annual celebration included events at all of Red Hat's more than 80 offices, including the company's new headquarters in downtown Raleigh. But last week wasn't all about flash and excitement. Events like this are also about recruitment. Red Hat has been relying on the buzz around its culture to fill seats at its new headquarters, and visibility will enhance that buzz. You should know that five Blackstone-mentored firms snagged funds. $5.5 million. That's the total funding haul six Blackstone Entrepreneurs Network companies grabbed during the third quarter. Five are based in the Triangle. Blackstone was launched in 2011 with a gift from the Blackstone Charitable Foundation. The network connects veteran entrepreneurs with startups for mentorship as well as access to their own industry and investment connections, and it seems to be working. Funded technologies include several we have written about before, such as e-nicotine technology, a Chapel Hill startup trying to create a clean nicotine inhaler, and Kiona Health, a Chapel Hill health technology firm. There's a new leader chosen for Wake County Economic Development. A familiar face will be taking over when outgoing longtime director Ken Atkins retires in December from the Wake County Economic Development. Adrian Coyle, the former executive director of the Raleigh Economic Development, has been chosen to succeed Atkins effective December 23rd. Coyle has, for the past 3 years, been working as the business development director for the Durham office of Lend-Lease U.S. Construction Incorporated, an international construction